On the Empire Podcast this week, it's time to ignore your mother and run with scissors because Blade Runner 2049 is here. Blade Runner. And we have Denis Villeneuve and Sir Ridley Scott here to talk about it. All this and more on the only movie podcast that recently saw an origami reindeer Christmas decoration and wondered if we might all be replicants. Hello, Pod. I'm Helen O'Hara, and I'm afraid that I'm hosting this week because Chris is just off a flight from New York and is so jet-lagged he's actually wearing trousers for once. That means the Winchesters will be keeping their shirts on. And obviously that I tried to write an intro fitting a song about the Winchesters to the opening number of Hamilton, which, for the sake of your ears, I just decided not to do. But that is not the only theatrical link for this week's episode, because this week we are sponsored by The Ferryman, which is the new play on stage at the Gielgud Theatre in London. It's written by Jez Butterworth, who, of course, wrote, among other things, Spectre in the Bond franchise. It is directed by Sam Mendes, so its filmmaking credentials are super on point. And this is a play that has already played to huge critical acclaim and five-star reviews at the Royal Court before opening in the West End, where it's been playing to sold-out houses. But there are still tickets. It's open until the 6th of January 2018. You can get tickets from as little as £12. They do front row day seats at the box office, which if you turn up at 10:30 on the day of, you can chance your luck and try and get a ticket. Get thee down to the Gielgud. Anyway, joining me this week is a colleague of such lethal cunning that we only need one extra person on the pod. He is lethal enough for all of them. That's right. It is the quiet man, a former boxer who retires to a small Irish village where... No, wait.
What?
Not quite. It is John Nugent. Hello.
Hello.
So it's just you and me.
Just us, yeah.
It's a bit weird.
I've taken my trousers off in honour of Chris.
I mean, it wasn't a challenge.
I mean, I'm happy to put them back on if you feel more comfortable.
If you wouldn't mind, yeah. Hang on, why isn't this HR button working on the phone? Why aren't they coming? Oh, God. So we should have a question. I believe that you chose this week's question, John.
I don't know what gives you that idea.
Well, let's have a look and see if the listeners can figure it out. At Monty H. Withnail on Twitter asks, a battle royale between the hardest movie Johns, John Matrix, John McClane, John Wick, or John Rambo, who wins? Why would you choose
Great
that,
question,
John?
Great question, Monty H. Withnail, or whatever your name was. Great question.
Right, so what do you think?
It's a good question, isn't it? I mean, until now, I'd never realised that there were so many sort of badass movie Johns, but there actually are quite a few, aren't there? Because it's such a sort of common and boring name that any parent with lacking in imagination would give to their child.
Oh my God. I can't believe you just said that about your own mum and dad. Disgraceful.
I think it's got to be out of that four.
Right.
John Matrix. I just can't imagine anyone else going up against the Austrian oak and his giant deer petting skills. I mean, if you think about it, John McClane is he's got a lot of ingenuity.
He's resourceful.
Yeah. He's got a gift of the gab.
Sure. He's got a machine gun. Ho, ho, ho.
Yeah, he's got all of that. But I don't know if stacked against Arnie, he would quite have...
So much.
John Rambo would just get a bit weepy and tearful because he's dealing with a lot of stuff. What was the other one, John?
John Wick. Now, you see, this is an interesting one because I feel like John Wick, quickness, going for the headshot against John Matrix, like that is an actual, that's a match. You know, that one,
yeah.
That one's a tough one to call.
That's true. John Wick has got a good aim, hasn't he?
I think he'd be faster. Like we've seen him take down really big men.
That's true.
I don't know.
If we extended it to other Johns, you know, other movie Johns.
Are there other, which ones are you thinking of? Nugent doesn't qualify, okay? You're not in a movie.
I'm not in a movie. And if I was, I'd struggle against, you know, the PA of any of these Johns, to be honest. There's Detective John Kimble. There's another Arnie John. You remember John Kimble?
Was that Kindergarten Cop?
I'm Detective John Kimble.
Right.
I'm a cop, you idiot.
I mean, I fancy his chances against six-year-olds, but I'm not sure I fancy his chances against his other self as John Matrix, really.
No, maybe not.
I mean, I have to say, Chris did actually send in his take on this, because I sent him the question. He said, my pick is John Matrix, so he's with you.
Yeah.
Then Wick, then Rambo, then McClane. He's just a cop. He'd get slaughtered in seconds.
Yeah. I mean, if it was a skyscraper and he had lots of places to hide, then maybe John McClane might have more of a...
Yeah.
More of a chance.
What if it was like a Raid-style skyscraper? Because in that case... I mean, you can see any of them fighting their way up it or down it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, Wick would have a good shot, wouldn't he?
Yeah, literally. Yeah.
Literally.
Double tap in the head.
Yeah. How about John Doe from Seven?
As in
Kevin Spacey's character.
Oh, that's mean. I don't want to let him near any of these people.
So you think that, you know, John Wick has got the drop on him, and then a delivery truck comes up and it's like John Wick's puppy's head in a box.
You monster.
And so whatever he does, he's already won.
Wow.
I mean, if we're talking about the psychological warfare, then I'm voting for Kevin Spacey in Seven.
That is, I mean, that's, I don't know what to think now.
A little bit dark.
I mean, very, very, very dark.
Okay, I'll bring it back for you, Helen. You'll like this one. John Carter.
John Carter
of Mars.
Well, now, are we on Earth or on Mars? Because he's much stronger on Mars.
But presumably they'd all be much stronger on Mars.
That is true, which is terribly unhelpful.
So it would level the playing field a little bit.
Or unlevel it again.
Yeah.
I mean, again, he'd be in with a shot against John McClane. I feel like there are similar signs.
Yes.
But it would depend on the weapons at that point, wouldn't it? You know, I think John Carter probably better with a sword.
That's true.
With a rifle, maybe.
Yeah.
Significantly less good with a handgun.
Yes. Or, you know, if we're talking about John Matrix, he likes to throw phone boxes about, you know. It's quite an impressive weapon. Okay, this is a good one. John Anderton, as in Tom Cruise from Minority Report. So he would see all of the deaths ahead of time and anticipate them and then stop them? Or?
Well, if he had Samantha Morton with him, sure.
Yes, yeah.
But again, we're looking into weapons now. Like, does he have a six stick with him? You know?
Yeah. I that's a good question.
So, I'll be honest. Monty H. Withnail, I feel like you need to be more precise in your questioning. Like, are we following sort of, you know, traditional dueling rules where, right, you know, the challengee gets to set the weaponry of choice? I mean, because if it's just a fist fight, I mean, John Matrix
let's assume we're just all locking them in a warehouse, right? Like, it's Reservoir Dogs.
Okay.
There's no weaponry. Or maybe they're allowed, like, one handgun each or something, and it's all in a circle in the middle.
Wow. Okay.
Let's assume it's a level playing field as far as weaponry goes.
I do feel it comes down to Matrix and Wick in that case.
Yeah.
And then the winner is...
It's Matrix.
I mean, I'm going to say Wick just because, you know, in this house we love and respect Keanu Reeves, so...
I look, nothing against Keanu, but Arnie would crush him.
Nothing against Keanu, but he would be a small pancake on the floor, says John. Well,
yes.
There you go. You heard it here first. If you want your question read out on the Empire podcast and treated with exactly that level of intellectual
rigor,
that is the only word, then please do send them in. We are on Twitter at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast or we won't see it. We are on Facebook, where we're also Empire Magazine, and people don't message us there, so, you know, it'd be a novelty if you did. And we're also, of course, you can email us at podcast@empireonline.com. So, shall we have a guest? I mean, we've got a lot of news to get through, but I feel like we should, you know, mix it up a bit, get another voice in here. Let's start with film's favourite French-Canadian. I'm sorry, Celine Dion. It's true. She's fashion's favourite French Canadian at the moment. But film's favourite French Canadian is Denis Villeneuve, the director of Arrival, Sicario, Prisoners, Incendie, and now this week's long-awaited, much-talked-about, incredibly anticipated Blade Runner 2049. He came into London recently and he was talking to John.
Me, yes.
Cool. Enjoy.
We're delighted to welcome to the Empire podcast Denis Villeneuve. How are you, sir?
I'm great. How about you?
Very well, thank you. So it's been a couple of years since you signed on to Blade Runner 2049, and it's been, well, about 35 years since we were last in that world. How does it feel now you're at the finish line? You're nearly done.
it's a big relief because the movie is finished right now. Mm-hmm. As we speak, it's like a month ago maybe, and I'm relieved because when I looked at the final object, is very close to my initial dreams.
Okay.
When I started to design the movie with Roger Deakins in Montreal 2 years ago, we had some wishes, and they are on the screen right now. And that is so I feel I have no idea how the world will react to the movie, if it would be welcome or not. That I have no control over that. But I know that the movie has a soul and it has its own personality. And I think, and I believe that it pays respect to the first movie in regards about the style. And it's a kind of a love letter to the first movie, I would say. Yeah.
That's really interesting that you say your vision sort of has arrived on screen, because so much of making a film is compromise, right? There's about having a vision and then having to...
Reality is very abrasive.
Yeah.
And it's like I'm coming from an indie world filmmaking,
right,
where sometimes you can write a scene 4 years ago about a sunny day, and you arrive in the morning, it's pouring rain, and you have to adjust. I'm used to adjust myself, you know.
Yeah.
And for this time, we had control over the elements. We designed the shoot, so we will control everything. So it was like, of course, there's like things that I have no control over, but I'm talking. No, I mean, I don't know what I'm talking about right now. I have control over everything.
Yeah.
The thing that was difficult was communication.
Right.
Because I'm used to work directly with artists, you know, to sit beside a cinematographer, to have a direct contact with the production designer.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was working with hundreds of artists
right.
all around the world that right. were working for us. That sometimes to make sure that they got the tune, that they got the music right, I'm talking about the design, or that was a journey.
Yeah.
And until the very last second, I had to be very present to make sure that we were on the right direction. It was like every shot was a battle.
Yeah.
I wish for the next movie I will find a way to increase the communication process, so it will be easier for everybody. Yeah.
This is the first sequel you've ever directed. Is it stepping into someone's world, like Ridley Scott's world? Did you find that restrictive, or was that like a fun challenge? Was that like an interesting challenge?
It was a frightening challenge.
Yeah.
And it was I didn't want to feel like a vandal in a church. You know,
right.
it's like the first movie is such a masterpiece. Honestly, it's not a word I use very often. Masterpiece. Mm-hmm. Like the first Blade Runner is a landmark in film history, and everybody knows that. So it's like it's something that how do you evolve? So that's why I'm saying that there was a long process of trying to find a way to invade to and in a way to. For the best and the worst, to destroy the first movie, to make it comes to life again. You have to. It's like when you take a book or you take a play to adapt to the cinema. You have to transform it in a very radical way. And I did the same in some ways. I didn't cut and paste. I didn't redo Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. I did a total different movie.
Yeah,
with the same that pays respect and add the same kind of some qualities to it. But it's a total different approach.
Do you remember the first time you saw the original Blade Runner?
I did. I remember vividly. One of the most striking things is the opening, which was one of the good ones in the film history, I think.
Mm.
I will say that the thing that struck me about when I remember my very first contact with the first movie is that at the time... when I saw it in 1982, it's like there was like fanzines that were there, like Film Fantastic or Starlog, you know, that was our only link and links at the time with movies to know what was coming out. And I remember seeing images at the front cover of those two magazines. I was from a small town in Canada, so there was no internet at the time. It was very it's there's a phenomenon that I'm trying to explain. It's just when you see images as an audience member, you see there's a promise, there's a dream. You see those images and you try to imagine what the movie will be, and it's always, most of the time, sadly, you're disappointed. You see the movie and it's like it's disappointing. And for Blade Runner, it was the opposite. The movie was much better. That it was more impressive. It was raising questions. It was like moving in a way that I was not expecting. It was like quite unique experience. And I will say that sci-fi, I'm a sci-fi fan. And saying this, honestly, there's not a lot of sci-fi movie that I love. Most of the time, I'm disappointed by them. Mm-hmm. They are childish or not very profound, but Blade Runner was like something different.
Yeah. So you're hoping that some young people seeing the Empire cover with Blade Runner 2049 will hope that it's better than the actual cover itself.
Boy, I put myself in a different difficult position. This time it's difficult because the expectations no matter. I knew from the start, and I accepted the fate that no matter how good the movie will be, it will be always compared to a very powerful piece of art.
Yeah,
and that that will be the fate, and that so when you accept that your chances of success are incredibly narrow, and that the chances of failure are huge. but that you still have the drive and the passion and the joy it's you kind of find a very powerful freedom. It becomes like a pure artistic act without expecting any reward. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. We just did that by pure love for cinema. You know, it's a conversation I had very early on with Ryan Gosling, and we both felt, all right, it's like a suicidal mission in the dark. We jump with no parachute,
wow.
and we hope that there will be something we can land on that will not kill us. And so it's artistically, I mean, we did it, and we did it with that joy, you know.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's a great attitude. Yeah,
it was the only way to do it.
Yeah,
honestly.
Ridley Scott obviously wanted to direct this film originally.
Yes.
What was your sort of working relationship? Because I understand he was only on set for a day or so.
Yeah. The thing is that first of all, I needed his blessing. That was one of the conditions. I needed to sit in front of the man and ask him. Basically, I said to Ridley, if you tell me that. You're not okay with me taking the wheel, I'm stepping out of your office saying thank you, and I will not do it.
Right.
I can do this movie only if you tell me that it's okay. And he was a gentleman, very generous, telling me, giving me insights on the genesis of the first movie from his point of view, his sources of inspirations. And at the end of all this, he said, this movie is yours. I'll be there if you need me. If you need any advice, I'll be there. Otherwise, you're alone. You're free. So I was 100% free doing this movie.
Wow.
He came on set one day just to visit, to see.
Okay.
And I will remember he was behind me. At one point, he came on set, and Ridley never goes on set of other directors. I've been told, but he came just to by curiosity. And at one point, I look at him and I say, "Ridley, who are your favorite directors?" And he said to me, "You know, I was a big fan of Ingmar Bergman,
yeah.
and of Kubrick too. Those were my masters. I say, so how would you feel if you were trying to direct something with Bergman behind your shoulder? He started to laugh and he left. Because for me it was unbearable.
Yeah,
I mean, it was like, it's like I have so much respect for the man. And I honestly, it's like, it's, I felt noise. And honestly, doing this movie just increased my respect for him.
Yeah.
Because as much as I dreamed making sci-fi for a long time, since decades, I was not, I didn't imagine how difficult it is to design a world.
Hmm.
And so my respect for artists like Ridley Scott just increased more. Yeah. He's quite a master. Yeah.
Yeah. Is it true that you originally wanted David Bowie to appear?
Yes. But it's, listen, when we started the casting, it was a first idea. You know, when you read the screenplay and you have some, there's the initial dreams when you see the movie, and then where you see actors, and a lot of those actors that were at the birth of the dream are in the movie right now. But there were the first idea was for the Neander Wallace, one of the main characters, was the idea was to go to David Bowie. Why? Because the character needed to be bigger than life, to have that kind of sacred quality, to have that kind of death, and also I felt it was like for me, I always felt that David Bowie was one of the one of the inspiration for the original Blade Runner. You know, he was Blade Runner before Blade Runner was so ahead of his time, and I felt that it was a kind of made total sense to invite him to be part of this adventure, and everybody was very excited by the idea, and we were and we had heard that he will be available, and then we heard the terrible news that we lost that great artist, and it took me forever you know, it's very strange when as a director you dream so strongly about something. So when I learned that unfortunately he left us, I there was the mourning of the man and the artist, of course, but I had to mourn a long time for the dream of who I will see that could replace and then the idea of Jared Leto came, but it's an idea that came very far away in time. I mean, I had to mourn for a long time.
Mm.
So it's a strange process.
No,
for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, and then Jared for, and honestly, I'm very proud of what Jared did. Yeah.
I mean, he's a very much a larger than life character in many ways, and you know, a rock star as well. So he fills some of those roles. I mean, what was your experience like with Jared? Because you hear stories that he stays in character and he takes it very seriously. I mean, what was it like?
I rarely see so much I rarely saw that amount of commitment in an actor. So professional, so prepared. Jared prepare on all levels, from the tone of his voice to his gestuality, to where he studied, because his character is blind, he studied blind people. He had a friend who is blind, and he studied his gestures, postures, intonations, micro detail. He's a maniac. I mean, very maniac about that. I heard all those stories, so I was curious. I said, okay, what could he done? A bit afraid at the same time. And I wanted him to have like contact lenses, and we did lenses that were like based on the very close to what a blind person look like. But Jared insisted that he will himself also be blind by the lenses, so it means that he will see nothing. So he insisted. Jared never saw my film crew. He never saw.
Wow.
He spent the entire the camera test, the rehearsals, the all the shoot blinded. he came blind. That's okay. I'm not disappointed. I was like, so it was so amazing to see him, and frightening at the same time, because he was putting himself in this strange, dangerous position sometimes, not seeing, you know. So he was coming on set, leaded by his assistant. And it would create a tension on set that I deeply loved, because it was like a sacred moment when he was walking on set. All the crew became always becoming very quiet.
Yeah.
And we were seeing, and it created such a beautiful tension.
Yeah.
And it was very inspiring. And I saw the level of commitment and all the actors all around him. It was like we felt the danger I deeply love working with him. Honestly, I hope it will happen again, because it was quite a journey and very, very inspiring. Yeah.
I think I'm almost out of time. I just wanted to ask very quickly, there is a sequel to Sicario in the works, and you are not directing it. Do you feel a little bit like Ridley Scott passing his baby on to someone else?
The thing is that it was strange, because as I agreed to do Blade Runner, I learned that they had asked me to read the screenplay of Soldado, which is a very beautiful screenplay written by Taylor Sheridan, the screenwriter of the original Sicario. And as much as I loved it, I had to decline. And they asked me if I would like to be part of it, in any way. And I said, you know, no. I don't want to meet the new boyfriend of my ex-girlfriend. You know, I wish her good luck. I want her to have fun. But it's like, it's just, I felt that Stefano Solima, the director, needed to have space and freedom. So I wished him good luck. And I knew the movie was in strong hands. But it's very strange for me to know that the characters evolve in somebody else's mind. I can't wait to see the movie. Yeah. I've seen nothing. They wanted to show me cuts. They wanted to show me dailies. I said, no, I don't want. If he needs me, I'll be there. But otherwise, I don't want to see. I want to sit in the theater and enjoy the experience of discovering this movie that I can't wait to see. It's like, it's going to be very exciting, I must say, for me.
Well, we look forward to that. And we look forward to Blade Runner 2049. Denis Villeneuve, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
So he was the one with the French accent, right?
That's right, if you weren't sure which one of us was which.
Thank you for clarifying.
Yes.
Yes. So we should talk about some news. We are going to review, obviously, Blade Runner later in the show.
Yes.
Don't worry. We haven't forgotten. But there's a lot of news to get through this week first. So where do you want to start?
How about we start with the Goldfinch?
Yeah, let's do that.
That broke sometime yesterday, I believe, as we record. So The Goldfinch is a book by Donna Tartt, a very good book by Donna Tartt.
Hugely good, yeah, amazing book.
Published in 2014, and that is now in the process of being adapted, and it seems that Ansel Elgort has the lead role.
So Elgort of The Fault in Our Stars fame, for example.
Or the Baby Driver.
Baby Driver, most recently, of course.
Most recently, yeah.
And the book is like, the book is enormous. Like if you run out of doorstops and you have The Goldfinch, like, you're sorted. You know, it will cover that eventuality, even with a heavy door. But it's also like, it's a really good book. It's the story of a boy who becomes a young man who loses his mother in an attack, isn't it? Or a disaster at a museum.
It's like a terrorist attack at an art museum. Yeah.
Like a bomb goes off, basically. And in the aftermath of this bomb, he picks up a small painting of the Goldfinch from this museum and essentially makes off with it almost accidentally, like it's just something he does out of shock. And he keeps it with him for years and years, and we see him dealing with the fallout in his life from the loss of his mother and from, you know, having to make his way kind of alone in the world in some ways. It's I would have thought a difficult book to adapt.
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of Goldfinch fans will be a little bit nervous about this. Because it is so huge and expansive and takes in a lot of characters and a lot of, you know, it spans quite a lot of years. You know, it starts out as young teenagehood and it ends up sort of as an early man. But we've got Brooklyn director John Crowley on board to direct it. And Brooklyn was very good.
Brooklyn was great.
So, you know, that's a positive thing. And Ansel Elgort has sort of proved that he's, you know, he can carry a film, as he did with Baby Driver and The Fault in Our Stars. So... Yeah, I think so. He's playing Theo, by the way. He's playing the lead character.
Sorry, yeah, we should maybe actually name him.
Yeah, he's carrying this film. So yeah, we shall see, as we often say.
We shall, but you know, after Baby Driver, you're right. We've got to be pretty optimistic for that one. Right. So that's good stuff. Speaking of films that we increasingly have to be optimistic about, even though we may not have intended to be in the first place, Venom has added another interesting piece of casting. Jenny Slate is now lined up to play a scientist in this film. Jenny Slate, of course, most recently appeared in Gifted opposite Chris Evans. She was, of course, the, I think, writer and star of Obvious Child a few years ago. She's brilliant. And she's also signed up to join the cast of Venom, which now includes Tom Hardy, Michelle Williams and Riz Ahmed. Either they're writing checks made of gold to these people, or it's a genuinely good script, right?
I don't understand what's going on here. Is this is it really Venom, or is it Venom just like, is it like a front? Is it a gangster front? And it's actually like a Sundance indie film.
Is it a film about the song Venom? Is it a film about the perfume?
Venom, you know. Venom is like a sort of Williamsburg coffee bar that they they all congregate in and talk about their lives. I can't quite make head nor tail of it, but it is a fantastic cast. So maybe it's going to be a good film?
Maybe it's going to be awesome. We've got a script by Scott Rosenberg and Jeff Pinkner, Ruben Fleischer directing. They've got a 5th of October 2018 release date all lined up.
Wow, so that's less than a year.
Less than a year, the clock is ticking. Well, but there's got to be something there.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. We keep sounding surprised, but, you know, it's a thing that's happening.
It is a thing that's happening. Another thing that's happening is many Avatar sequels, as we all know.
So many.
And a new addition to Avatar 2 through, I don't know, infinity, is Kate Winslet. Kate Ooh. Winslet is re-teaming with her Titanic director, James Cameron.
I guess time heals all wounds.
I guess so. Yeah, this is what happens to her after she clambered off the bit of wood in the sea.
The bit of wood that was big enough for two people, that bit of wood.
Yeah, exactly. So she is playing someone called Ronal, R-O-N-A-L. We don't know anything about this character, but James Cameron said in a statement that he's been looking to work with Kate Winslet again for the last 20 years, and she can't wait to see her bring the character Ronal to life.
Ronal. Do we think it's a baddie? Do you cast Kate Winslet as your baddie in this film?
I don't know. I mean, we've got literally zero information to go off.
So. Yeah, we do. I know. I'm just going from the name Ronal. Does it sound like a goodie or a baddie?
Ronal. It sounds Irish, if I'm honest.
Are you mixing up Ronan with another name?
Ronan and Donal.
It's, oh, my God.
You know, it's...
You've cracked it.
It's maybe an Irish version of the Navvies. Wait, and...
Navvies. Oh, my
Navvies
goodness.
Were Irish, weren't they? The Irish Navvies. Perfect.
I think it's pronounced Navi, but, you know, sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Shall you not go to the Tree of Life?
Okay, just to tell you, you're committing a hate crime right now, so... Like, you know, again, I'm pressing the HR button on the phone.
But that was pretty accurate, right?
Anyway, let's go to the next story.
Okay. Swiftly. Yeah.
Jared Leto, who's, of course, back on our cinema screens this week in Blade Runner, has signed on to play Hugh Hefner, who died last week at the age of 91. He is now the subject of a biopic, which will be directed by Brett Ratner. So that's certainly a way to convince us of Hugh Hefner's feminist legacy.
I believe the working title is Toxic Masculinity, the movie.
Another one, it's like 400 in that series, my God. I mean, okay, like, let's again try to find the good in this. There must be good in this. Jared Leto is a very gifted actor. Mm-hmm. He basically wears silk pyjamas a lot of the time anyway. Genuinely, if you look through his fashion sense, it is out there. Yes. He's very comfortable in colourful patterned silks, mm-hmm. which certainly plays into the character. And he often is, I'm sure, in life, surrounded by beautiful women. So, you know.
Certainly.
He's done that method research.
I mean, you know, I think they've been talking about this for a little while, but obviously this comes hot on the heels of the news of Hugh Hefner's death, and since his death, there's been a lot of debate about I've seen people say he was one of the great civil rights leaders of our time, and I've seen people say he was, you know...
Otherwise,
let's say, you know, setting the course of feminism back, choose how many decades, I guess. So, I don't know, it's certainly an interesting and colourful life, and it could prove to be an interesting and colourful film. I don't want to sound too... Every day is Christmas Eve.
Hey.
Yeah.
Nicole Kidman is on a bit of a winning streak at the moment, I have to say. She hasn't really put foot wrong in quite some time. I saw her recently playing a punk. I've seen her in a weird film opposite Colin Farrell, in which they're both great. I bet you can figure out which one. And obviously Big Little Lies was absolutely tremendous. She has now signed up for Karen Kusama's next planned movie, which is a crime film called Destroyer. And that will see her play a detective at the LAPD, Erin Bell, who was placed undercover in a sort of a cult in the California desert. So this happened earlier in her career. Years later, the leader of the gang reemerges, and she has to try and track him down, confronting the demons of her own past.
Mm.
Demons. Good, sign me up. I'm sure the Winchesters will be along any minute, eh?
Not that sort of demon, Helen.
No. Well, that's less exciting.
No shirts off for this film.
There are no shirts off. We're having a shirt off free day.
Okay, sorry. You're right. It's a very serious... serious drama about shirted men.
There you go. Okay, a couple of very quick ones to finish off with. Bad news for all fans of bald men. Fast and Furious number 9. Fast 9 Furious? I mean, they've got to do something with it, I don't know. Has been pushed back. The release now will not be until 2020.
No!
It's a full year, man!
No!
We were due in 2019.
I need my Hobbs fix.
And don't we all? I mean, wait, 2019? Even that's a long time to wait.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the 10th film had been penciled in for 2021. Unless they're shooting them back-to-back, you'd imagine that one's also going to be moving.
Mm.
But basically, everyone's expected back, obviously, because they're family, you know. We don't know anything more about it. We haven't been offered a reason for the shift. It might be because there isn't a director yet, which tends to hold things up just a tad.
Sure.
But...
maybe it's there's some sort of candy-ass dispute that they need to sort out, you know. They need to, like, sort it out like family do.
Like family, with a couple of... What was the beer?
Corona.
Coronas, a couple of Coronas.
They just
got to
settle it over a barbecue. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope everyone's all right. I do worry about those guys.
I mean, I think they're okay. They look like they're okay, right?
I mean, well, yeah. financially, I'm sure they're fine. You know, but did you not hear there was a bit of a dispute between The Rock and Tyrese Gibson? Recently. Did you hear about this?
Recently, no.
Yeah. So there is supposedly a Hobbs and Shaw spin-off series spin-off film with The Rock and Jason Statham.
Amazing.
That's due to be happening, which, you know, analysts are expecting it to be the greatest film of all time. it seems Tyrese has a bit of beef with The Rock about him. It's not really clear why, but he's called them out on Instagram a couple of times.
No.
Yeah.
The site of all the greatest beefs.
I know, exactly. That's where real men duke it out on the Instas. It's not really...
Hashtag bliss.
I'm not sure if Tyrese is just angry about this spin-off, or I think he was a bit concerned that the spin-off might delay the series, which may still be the case.
No.
So that could be the reason, is that instead of seeing Fast and Furious 9, we're going to see... Hobbs and Shaw, you know, in their sort of buddy.
Hobbs and Shaw, friendship is magic. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. That, if that's the subtitle, I will be so happy. It's just 3 hours of bald men just skipping through fields in joy and happiness. So, we'll wait to hear on the real reason for this delay, but let's hope they're all friends. That's all I care about.
Yes, and also let's hope that, you know, it is Fast and Furious. Like, they're not supposed to slow down that much,
right,
you know?
So right, exactly.
Not thematic at all. Very quickly before we move on, we should say that Maleficent 2, which is a thing that is also happening, has found a director in Joaquin Ronning. Apologies to literally everyone for that pronunciation. He's already been handed one big Disney franchise with Pirates of the Caribbean Salazar's Revenge, or whatever it is we're calling it today, and is working solo this time without his Kon-Tiki directing partner, Espen Sandberg, on Maleficent 2. So that's going ahead. Angelina Jolie has said she'll return. It's all under wraps plot-wise. But original writer Linda Wolverton was back, and Jez Butterworth has also taken a crack at the script. So, you know, it appears that it could be in cinemas in 2019. Maybe it's taken Fast and the Furious its release date. Probably not, though.
Well, you know, I know which one I'd like to see.
I know, right? Maleficent 2? Sure.
Maleficent 2.
I mean, if it's between bald heads and horned heads, what are you going to do? Like, it's a tough choice. I mean, the first one looked stunning. I think it just had maybe a little bit like, maybe like 40% too much story. And I feel like if they got maybe like 40% less story in this one, it might just work.
Maybe.
Speaking of reasons to be cheerful, there's a new Empire this week.
Hey! Hey!
And it is a gorgeous Justice League one. I have to say, I now get sent the subscribers cover, which is really good. Like, don't get me wrong, the newsstand cover is lovely, but the subscribers cover is a special illustrated Justice League image by one of the big DC artists. It's gorgeous. I might hang it on my wall, and it's really, really fascinating. We've got Chris's coverage of his visit to the Justice League. There are some brand new pictures with Wonder Woman surprisingly front and center. It's almost like her film has been a massive success, and they've realized that everyone loves her and wants to see more of her.
Funny that.
So weird. So that's the big that's the big cover movie. That's the big feature. But we have a huge packed house. Paddington 2, which I saw some super charming footage of from recently, is in there as well. Also by Chris. What the heck? Come on, there's freelancers here who need work. It is, it's given the headline Marmalade Boogaloo, which is a reason to buy it alone. But it is a super charming film that will involve Paddington getting sent to prison because he's trying to get his aunt a birthday present, which is the most Paddington reason to end up in prison that I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah.
And I'm totally delighted by it. We have a tribute to the late, the great Harry Dean Stanton, which is a lovely look back through his life and work. And what a body of work it was. Dan has been to talk about Stranger Things 2. That's what they're calling it. Not just a second season, but an entirely sequel-y kind of experience. And again, if you're looking for charming pictures of adorable little people dressed up as Ghostbusters, this is the place to get them. Hayley Campbell, I think, fulfilled a lifelong dream by profiling Pumping Iron, the 1977 Arnold Schwarzenegger bodybuilding documentary that first launched the Austrian Oak and thereby John Matrix on an unsuspecting world. What a deal. And then we have The Great Death of Stalin, Armando Iannucci's new film. Everything you need to know about what I think might be the funniest film of the year. And if it isn't, what a year, man. It's an incredible film. Andy Serkis talks us through his directorial debut, Breathe, which is a lovely, lovely film. It's opened the LFF, the London Film Festival, this week. And it's just a packed issue. What can I say? Grace Jones doing Pint of Milk here, people. We've got Killing of a Sacred Deer profiled in the news section. We've got Gunpowder for all you Kit Harington fans. Vince Vaughn, as you've never seen him before, in Brawl in Cell Block 99. Don't worry if you've missed the first 98. Hey, it's happy birthday to that joke. And Gary Oldman in Darkest Hour, dressed up as Winston Churchill and looking nothing like himself. I really can't get my head around that one, I'll be honest. I'm having real trouble with it. Oh, The Rock. There you go, John. The Rock is in it.
Oh, thank God. Yes, that was my piece, actually. Oh,
there you go.
Yeah, that's... I went to Hawaii and hung out with The Rock.
I mean, oh, I can see how you would forget that. No big deal.
I can't believe I forgot that. Yeah, that was, the favourite thing that I ever did, perhaps. So that was nice. Please read that.
So that is this month's Empire Magazine price, £4.70 in all good and or evil news agents. Get after it if you're not already subscribing. I think it's time for another guest, don't you?
Yes.
Enough of us wittering on. So he is the man who started this whole Blade Runner thing with a sci-fi movie that no one liked and hardly anybody saw in 1980. Times, however, have changed, and we've all realised that it's really quite magnificent. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Sir Ridley Scott who was talking to our dearly departed Phil. He hasn't died. He's literally just left. But he's still dear. Anyway, Phil and Ridley, take it away.
Ridley Scott, welcome to the Empire Podcast. You talk to us about Alien Covenant. Yes. You're back to talk about Blade Runner 2049 and hopefully a bit about Blade Runner itself. Yes. Will you at some point be back to tell us about Duelist 2?
Could be, but as I said, I'm not going to tell you what it is because it creates people. You know, ideas in this business are currency.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to be careful how much you speak, how much you talk, because they gong somebody across the world goes, I think I'll do that.
Yes.
So originality is currency.
But the reason I mentioned Duelist, obviously, that was your directorial debut. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Alien followed that, followed by Blade Runner.
Yeah.
So you are, in a way, kind of revisiting the earliest part of your career. Yeah. Are you a nostalgic man? Are you someone that looks back at his early work and
it's sentimental and not nostalgic?
This process must make you feel, must take you back to the early 80s, to the beginning.
No, I'm very forward-thinking.
Right.
I've never any regrets. People say, did you have any regrets about any film you made? I said, never, ever at all. And I always look forward. I'm a forward looker. I never look back.
Okay. Well, let me ask a different spin on that. If we had the gift of foresight in 1982, June, when Blade Runner was released in cinemas, and we'd come up to you and said, Ridley, we're going to be talking to you in a London hotel 35 and a bit years later about a sequel, what would you have said?
Well, I have to tell you, I thought I made something special. And it didn't matter how I was beaten up by whoever it was. The worst of all was Pauline Kael. I was old enough, I was 43 then, to think, you know, I don't really care. I'm just very pleased with what I made because I know it's special. So when it started to evolve, somebody at the time, post Blade Runner, immediately said, you know, this is going to come back and visit you. That was a year after the film was absolutely bashed and beaten up. And it suddenly surfaced with MTV. Well, how is it those musicians are always ahead of everyone else?
It's true, yeah.
Yeah. The what you think is an oik rock and roller is not, is usually pretty bloody smart. And they started to show its hand there. Then suddenly it came out of a drawer in Santa Monica where somebody had been asked and wanted us to supply print for the very few supporters of the Alien the Alien film. And what they came out with was an accident. Didn't have titles, had a bit of Jerry Goldsmith music and some new tracks from Vangelis on it with no titles at all and no voiceover. And the ending that ended up in the elevator, which was always the intention, and I think it was 65 mil.
Wow.
So they ran that, went, there was a gobsmack, and that was where it all began again.
Wow. When you look at the sort of myth and legends that have built up around Blade Runner in those years, are there things that people still don't know? Do you follow the kind of the debates online about all kinds of aspects of it? Is there?
I'm neither a Twitter nor a, what do you call it? I don't do any of that.
You're not on Instagram?
No. My phone, as long as it tells, I don't want to know how hot it is in Calcutta. As long as I make phone calls, that's all I'm caring about.
Unless you're in Calcutta, I suppose. Yeah. Denis Villeneuve, obviously, is directing this one.
Yes.
And you're producing.
Yes.
He tells a lovely story about you and Harrison Ford and he in a restaurant in Budapest where you shot the film. The way he tells it, you had lovely wine and a good conversation and it ended with you and Harrison shouting at each other across the restaurant. He may be exaggerating. Can you remember? What are your memories of that?
It was actually about summing this old adage about was he a replicant or not. And I said to him, dude, if you weren't a replicant, the film you're about to do couldn't exist. So when you see the film, you'll see what I mean. It's essential in the present film that he's a replicant.
Okay. So he's. So you've.
I'm not gonna tell you what it is.
No. Well, we're very consciously not going to get into the plot details, not least because.
But he has to be a replicant.
Okay. So you're at peace with Harrison about this now?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Sure. I never was at a peace with him. He and I were. I came from a different school of filmmaking that he was used to. You've got to remember, by the time I'd done this, I had a very successful office in Los Angeles, a big office in London, office in New York. I'd done the prize at Cannes for my first film, and I'd done Alien.
Mm.
I'd done 2,500, and my company's done 5,000 commercials
at
that point. So I'm not a learner.
No.
So I'm listening to these people telling me what I ought to do, and I at 44 you just don't accept that shit. So I just sat there, was smiling, and said, "I'm going to do it this way." And it was like I was a new guy on the block, but I'm not a kid.
No. At this point. No.
So I know exactly how to defend the realm.
What was your specific involvement with Blade Runner 2049? Were you on set very much? Did you try and steer clear?
My big thing was preparing the script, because the script was going to be done for me, because Alcon came to me and said, "Listen, we're going to buy the title. Before we do it, do you think there's a story here?" I said, "Absolutely." "What is it?" I said, "I'll tell you when you really get going. I'm not going to tell you right now." But it's a very clear and present story as to what it is. And from that, the evolution is kind of quite a big universe in the context of the Blade Runner realm.
Yeah.
And it's clear when you get it, but it carries you right through the story.
Okay.
And so it was so obvious as the nose on my face. And it all happens in the first 10 minutes of Blade Runner.
Okay.
Yes, there's the clue.
Right.
Right there.
Exciting. So one day on set.
Quite a long time. Script, Hampton, we met with Hampton. I met Brock with Hampton. Hampton thinks he was called lady. No, he wasn't. He was called first. He's such an old lady. Hampton came in, because I had the best time with Hampton when I was doing the original Blade Runner. And I spent 4 or 5 months with Hampton every day working. And I have to say, it was the best time I've had ever working with a writer, because there was a light ignition each day, and the idea grew from a play inside a small apartment to a universe of where it was, because I bring to everything to bear like a production designer. My strongest asset, I have a good eye.
Yeah.
Actually, a great eye. And I can come in, and I've already envisioned what it could be outside, and I was trying to bring that to bear, and Hampton had to tolerate that evolution, but he put it on paper with my every day egging him on, dropping in ideas and notions of what about this, what about that, the invention of Tyrell and all that.
Right.
And even then we said that you can't possibly call these things robots or replicant or
androids.
Find a name. Yeah. And David Webb Peoples, who came in to help him out in the latest period, his daughter was studying genetics and said, you know, the good word is replicants.
Yeah.
Replication, when replicants.
Yeah.
So then I brought Hampton back to do this. We sat in the London office, I don't know, probably 5-6 days. But we already, I think, knew, because of the first one, there was this obvious, very obvious story. So even the beginning of the movie that you'll see was going to be the beginning of the original Blade Runner.
Right.
The whole scene at the beginning was going to start off the original Blade Runner.
Okay.
Yeah. So we said, we start there, because we weren't able to do that. Great way to begin the movie.
Yes.
And then during that, I had a race on with, I was developing several things at once. So I was evolving Alien Covenant, which is an extension on Prometheus. Prometheus did so well, we went again. So it was an evolution of the Alien franchise, and we were way ahead of that, and I had to make a decision.
Right.
So then we came in with Denis.
The Battle of Britain has been something that's been on your IMDb page for a while. I just wondered, with the success of Dunkirk, whether that becomes a more appealing prospect.
It should. Was Dunkirk very successful or medium?
I think, yeah.
But I think I was kind of waiting for that, because if it's very successful, then it makes Battle of Britain viable.
Right.
Because you can go again on a different part of the war. But I got a good script, and I'm just kind of waiting to see.
Okay.
He did a good script, yeah.
I'm a massive fan of the original battle. Now, the original movie, star-studded.
Yeah, you have to personalize these stories. It's a bit like doing Getty. You've got to have a great Getty. You've got to have a great Gale. And there was a guy who used to work for Getty, who was Mark Wahlberg, believe it or not.
Right.
He was a fantastically straight character who is a... more than that, but for the purpose of this discussion, the security for John Paul Getty, and is excellent.
Okay.
You've got a fantastic trio, plus the son is great, Charlie.
So what would your Battle of Britain be a more intimate story than the...
There'd be a lot of in-flight stuff, which you can do in a funny kind of way, a lot easier and less dangerously today than you could if you're having two fly within 6 feet of each other. Just downright stupid. So you can get all that right, but I think it's always on the character, the character, the character.
Okay.
Story.
Alien Covenant.
Yeah.
You've talked about the idea of making another couple of movies set in the world.
Yeah.
Can you tell us any more about, sort of give us a sort of status update on where you're at with the sequel to that one?
I think the evolution of the alien himself is nearly over.
Right.
But what I was trying to do is transcend and move to another story, which would be taken over by AIs. And the world of the AI, and the world of the AI might create as a leader if he finds himself onto a new planet.
Right.
And from that, we had actually quite a big evolution, quite a big layout for the next one, for Covenant 2, whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I did Prometheus, I said to them, I think you can resurrect this whole notion, because the Alien franchise ran for four. Two were good. The other two were good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think when they finally did an Alien vs. Predator, I thought that put the lid on the stew. It was finished. And then I went back to them about, I think, 10 years later, and said, listen, I think we can do something. So we resurrected that to show how an alien may have come about. We did well enough from that, Prometheus, to go again. But I was told that the thing that they, you know, we did Prometheus for a pretty good price, not yet 200 million, not Mark. I don't do that shit. Ridiculous. That's like buying a bottle of red for £1,000, you've got to be an idiot. And you get a good one for like £50 or 30.
Really, we're journalists. A fiver.
Okay, well, you're only going for five. But I am very kind of frugal, very practical.
Yeah.
So I do Alien, Prometheus, I mean, really just very good price, and we make 450. So now you go, wow, there's life in the dog.
Yes.
So now we go again on Covenant, which is again roughly the same price 4 years later. So it's very frugal and a very ambitious film, and we did well again. So I think it's really about business, but it's commerce and art. And filmmaking will be that and should be that, unless you're making films for £100,000.
Yes.
If you're making a film for £1 million, a lot of money to lose.
Yeah.
If you're making a film for £260,000, you should be shot. Sorry.
Harsh, but yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
If you're making for £260,000, then you put P&A, £100,000, £360,000, then you go global. Let's say you make $800,000. Studio doesn't receive it, they only receive 400, so you're not out yet.
Right.
Because the other half goes to the exhibitor.
Of course. Yeah, of course.
So that's why the studios are limping, because there's too much money spent.
Yeah. So the franchise is sort of financially viable and for you creatively viable. In terms of the narrative, it seemed like at the end of Alien Covenant, it was hard to know where it was going to go next from a kind of a human point of view. Catherine Waterston seems to be kind of in deadly jeopardy, shall we say.
Yes.
David's behaviours that we've seen
end on a cliffhanger as opposed to completion.
But it felt like a cliffhanger where the person had fallen off the cliff slightly, or was at least falling.
It gives me an option to kind of fundamentally work it whichever way I want when you come in.
Do you have your first scene in your head?
No.
Okay.
No. I'm doing something else next.
Yes. Go on, tell us.
No, I can't.
Really?
No, I can't.
When will we find out?
Oh, in about 2 weeks.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And well, I'm already writing, I already prep. I discovered years ago, being in post, I'm sitting twiddling my thumbs.
Yeah.
So in post, I'm already prepping.
Yeah. Amazing. I just, prodigiously sort of productive filmmaker. Yeah, of course. I've got to wrap up, but just lastly, I mean, we've been talking about Blade Runner, the original, and the sequel now, all this time later. The intervening period, the legacy of that film is so profound on so many levels. I just wonder, from a filmmaking point of view, you must see a lot of films that you see Blade Runner in. You know, there's The Matrix, Strange Days, Ghost in the... Yeah, yeah.
Oh, no, that was whatever. And a lot of bands would come to me and ask me to do their digital work.
Okay.
Bob Dylan.
Wow.
Long close meeting with Bob for like 4 hours. Well, he'd had his accident. Well, you know, had a motorcycle, wasn't it? He nearly, I think, killed himself. This is 20 years ago. And I was called in to go meet Bob. And it was a 4-hour meeting because he loved Blade Runner. He had his brand new album coming out. One minute, he could do it. But he wanted me to do the whole bloody album. I said, Bob, I'll be out of work for a year doing it. Can you afford it? How much? He said, oh, no, I'm not going to do that.
Amazing. Bob Dylan, Blade Runner super fan. Thank you so much for talking to us on the podcast again, Ridley.
All right, so let's get going with reviews. Where should we start, John?
There's, you know, there's this tiny little film that, you know, no one's really been talking about called Blade Runner 2049. Oh, my God.
Yeah, we should probably give that a quick mention, really, sure. Shouldn't we? Yeah, it is. I mean, to say it's long awaited is true, but at the same time, I think long anticipated and long slightly feared that it might not live up to the storied reputation these days of the original. Luckily, and I'll give you a spoiler here, it's a 5-star review, it very much does. So Ryan Gosling is Officer K. He is a Blade Runner, like Harrison Ford's Deckard before him. So he's a sort of combination detective assassin, kind of bounty hunter who has to hunt down bioengineered humans who are known as replicants who have gone rogue, gone off the grid. Mainly he's after the old and discontinued Nexus 8 models who are still at large. So he meets one who's played by Dave Bautista on a protein farm and there discovers a buried box of bones which reveals a big secret which drives the rest of the plot. Now, all of that happens in about the first 5 minutes, and that's about all the plot I can tell you. Because they've asked us to keep even really fundamental facts about this film a secret. Which makes it a little bit difficult to review, I'm not going to lie. I can tell you about the characters in there. So obviously we've got Ryan Gosling as Kay, who is, I think, a bit like Deckard in the original, but again, not quite as hardened and not quite as cynical. He's sort of still kind of trying to find his place in the world. I think he's a little bit more optimistic and idealistic than Deckard was. He has a sort of holographic girlfriend who's called Joy, who's played by Ana de Armas, and she is like one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my entire life, but she's also just this... I think she kind of contributes to this feeling that you have that he's really optimistic and idealistic because she's obviously taken on his personality. She feels like Scarlett Johansson in Her, like she's been kind of shaped by his needs and preferences, I think. Mm. I can also tell you that Robin Wright is his boss, in charge of the Blade Runner division, I guess, and she seems like a really good boss. You know, I would work for her. She seems awesome. And there is also Harrison Ford. I can't say too much about Deckard either. I can tell you he doesn't turn up until quite late in the film. If you're waiting for him, you know, get comfortable. But he's there. And we also have, of course, Jared Leto as Wallace, who has kind of taken over the Tyrell mantle. He's not head of the Tyrell Corporation. He's got his own corporation. But he's very much in the same position as Tyrell was in the first film, as the designer of the new breed of replicants, the ones who can be trusted not to disobey in the way that the old did. And he's a mysterious and rather unknowable figure, I suppose. Yeah.
Mm.
I mean, it's very hard to talk about a film where something 5 minutes in is a spoiler.
Yeah. It's very pretty, though, right?
Oh, my God, it's gorgeous. Yeah. So here's the good news. Roger Deakins is obviously cinematographer DOP for this one, and he is a 13-time Oscar nominee and has yet to win. He's not the most Oscar-nominated in history not to have won, but he's, you know, he's getting up there in terms of nominations. I think the most without winning is now 20. Who's one of the sound mixers. He doesn't mind. I should make clear, like, we're all gagging for Roger Deakins to win an Oscar. Everyone in the industry wants him to win an Oscar. He doesn't care, I don't think. He seems to have nothing but respect for all his fellows. But I do think that this could be it. I think this could be his year. I mean, Chiva Lebeski has essentially taken a year off, I think. And the biggest competitor I've seen so far is probably Hoyt van Hoytma for Dunkirk. Mm. And I feel like this is more obviously impressive. I think Dunkirk is a great, great job, don't get me wrong, but it, you know, a lot of it is kind of daylight or looks like daylight or could be mistaken for daylight, whereas this one is clearly cinematography at its finest. Mm. And he's done a stunning job. Just the layers in some of those scenes, the sort of the mist, the fog, the dust in the air, the neon, all of these kind of Blade Runner shades and tones that you expect are there. Denis Villeneuve as well deserves a lot of credit for like really leaning into the bits of Blade Runner that people didn't like first time around. You know, this is a very slow, meditative, philosophical film that I don't think is obviously commercially successful on its own. I think the Blade Runner name will help it get there. But he takes risks that would not be allowed, I think, for a lesser filmmaker. And I think for the most part, they succeed. I've got some quibbles that I won't get into today, but it's a very good job on his part, as you would expect, because he really, you know, he's been pretty reliable so far. So yeah, I mean, you know, stunning work all across the board, no question. And as I say, Empire give it 5 stars.
5 stars. I think you'd call that a recommendation.
I think that is what we would call a recommendation, indeed. Yeah. What else have you seen? You've seen On the Road this week, haven't you, which is the new Michael Winterbottom film.
Yes, that's right. Now, this is not to be confused with the Jack Kerouac novel, because it has nothing to do with it, and it is maybe could have done with a more original title, perhaps, because it's a very literal description of what happened. So basically, in a nutshell, On the Road is a rock documentary. It's a rock gig following the band Wolf Alice, a very good band, but in a very sort of experimental touch that Michael Winterbottom likes to do, it's got a sort of semi-fictionalized elements added into it, which is a really interesting conceit. So there are genuine documentary elements where they will literally film the band performing as they tour around the country, living in a bus, basically, and the crew living amongst them in this, you know, in this incredibly claustrophobic atmosphere. But into this mix, Michael Winterbottom has thrown in 2 fictional characters, 2 actors who play, you know, fictionalized people. And essentially, as you would have heard from my interview with Michael Winterbottom last week or a couple of weeks ago, they strike up a sort of romantic relationship. And it's the idea, I suppose, is to create some sort of more authentic portrait of life on the road, of life as a touring musician or as a touring artist or as a touring crew member. In that, the sense that, you know, it's not just about being on stage. That's being on stage is an hour of your day, and the other 23 hours of the day are spent, you know, just living, I guess. And, you know, Michael Winterbottom's a director who's always been interested in that sort of very authentic portrait of life. He wants to capture realism in a, you know, very sort of brutal, honest, verite sense. And it's really interesting. You know, it's an experiment that I think, as you start watching it, it takes a little while to get used to. There are points where you try and figure out which parts are real and which parts are scripted. But it sort of works. It sort of flows in. I mean, the fictional characters are literally doing the jobs. So Estelle, played by Lee Harvey, who plays a sort of management PA, I suppose, and she just works for the band. And you just see her, like, collecting towels occasionally and just asking people for help and hanging out with the bands. And it feels like genuine hangouts, like they're just sort of sitting in a changing room jamming. And it's really hard to know what is staged and what is just literally these people, you know, hanging out like young people do. And it's really, there's something really intoxicating about watching that. And also, if you're a Wolf Alice fan, then it does work as a straightforward rock documentary. You know, they do show them playing music, and it's very nice to hear that music. It's a really interesting idea. It's a concept that works really well. The fusion of reality and fiction, I think, is just something quite you know, new and original. The thing with a lot of Michael Winterbottom films is he doesn't like to have a traditional narrative, so there's not a 3-act structure, there's not an arc which ends on a sort of satisfactory note. You know, nothing really happens. They just go on tour and then it stops. So if you're looking for a big dramatic film, then this is not the film for you, but it is a fascinating and sort of genuinely pleasurable couple of hours to spend in the company of this band and the characters that are thrown into it. So I really liked it. Empire really liked it. We gave it 4 stars.
Well, that which is a recommendation.
Which is indeed a recommendation.
Wow, what a streak. Can we keep this up for our third film, The Night is Short, Walk On Girl? Well, what do you think?
I certainly hope so.
No!
Oh!
I'm so sorry. So this is a Japanese animation directed by Masaaki Yuasa. It's really weird. If you liked the Simpsons episode where Homer ate the ghost chili... Do you remember El Viaje Misterioso de Nuestro Señor Homer? Nuestro Homer. This is kind of like that, but feature length. So it's super weird. So this girl with the black hair just kind of goes through life and has adventures. And there's a guy called Senpai who's a shy student with a massive crush on her who sort of follows her along and gets himself in all sorts of scrapes along the way. And there are these, you know, she gets involved in drinking contests with weird guys who live on trains. She meets perverts, gods, the god of the used book fair, which I think is a deity we all worship. She gets tied up in student drama, God bless her. There's a plague and she has to go around town, like, you know, bringing people soup. And yes, there's like insanely spicy food that causes explosions. So it's super weird. And I have to say, for like the first half, I wanted to die. Like, I hated it. I was like, why are these things happening and how can I stop them? It almost kind of won me over just from sheer kind of exhaustion, but I couldn't quite give it a 3. I mean, for sheer audacity, it's like a 17, but for, you know, coherent sense, it's like a minus 15. So I went for 2 stars. I feel like that's how it works.
That's very mathematically precise reviewing there, Helen.
But it is, I mean, it's, you know, if you're into weird, super trippy animation, this is absolutely the film for you this week, closely followed by Blade Runner. Oh! I'm kidding. I have nothing but respect, mostly. So those are, I think, the big films this week. Also out this week is The Glass Castle, which we gave 3 stars. The Mountain Between Us, that's the Kate Winslet and Idris Elba film, which also got 3 stars. So, you know, make up your mind. But let's be honest, you're all going to go and see Blade Runner 2049. So it doesn't really matter what we say now, does it?
Exactly.
So I think that's about it for this week's podcast. It's weird just having 2 people. It's like it's like a conversation without weird people. I don't understand how this works.
There's been remarkably few impressions this week, hasn't there?
I know. Can you do any impressions?
Hello, it's a little bear. It's my impression of Chris doing an impression of Jim Broadbent.
Wow, that's going to have them all.
Are we scraping the barrel yet? I feel like that's the barrel.
Yeah, I think we're through the barrel.
We're through the barrel.
We're wearing it now as a pair of trousers, which is useful given the lack of trousers generally in the podcast. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast, brought to you by The Ferryman at the Gielgud Theatre. As I said, get down there every day at 10:30. They have front row seats for £12. That is a bargain for a Sam Mendes directed, Jez Butterworth written play. Otherwise, you can join us next week for more film-related fun when we will be joined by the lovely Rebecca Ferguson. And with that, it's goodbye from John.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from me. I'm off to finish writing these supernatural Hamilton lyrics. Aw, yeah.